Thank you, good evening. Welcome to Enough Rope. Tonight, coming to you from the Parade Theatre here at NIDA. It's not often you get to meet someone who is both a student and a master of the same craft. Please welcome the comedian's comedian, Jerry Seinfeld.
Thank you very much.
Welcome, sir.
Wow. Thank you.
That's it, time. Thank you.
Gee, boy, I wish we had more.
Yeah, but it's been great.
But we covered a lot.
It's been...
Good night! See, if it was me, I would walk... We should go. You know, that would be the funny thing if we really left.
Well, you know... But boy, the ABC would be upset.
Yeah, well, it's worth it for a big laugh.
You've made a movie about bees.
Yes.
Why is a bee funnier than, say, a moth?
Are you seriously asking me that?
I'm seriously asking you that.
You've seen moths. Not much to look at, right?
Yeah.
You've seen bees.
Yeah.
You know about the honey.
Mm-hmm.
You know about the flowers.
Yes.
You know about the hives.
Yes.
Well, there's no comparison. The moth is a nasty, dusty, just stupid little insect is what it is. Whereas the bee is this highly scientific, advanced, sophisticated utopian. A bee lives in a future perfect world, which is a perfect setting for comedy.
It's
like Australia. It's a perfect place.
Oh,
it is.
You say that to all the countries.
Oh, no, I don't.
I'm guessing that at the end of this process, you know too much about the bee. Would I be right?
I know a lot, but, you know, when you're doing this kind of thing where you're trying to just make a funny movie, you have to just make up whatever you want. For example, in the movie, bees drive cars. Now, you would think if you could fly, why would you need a car? And that's exactly the point. They just, because they live a very civilized life, they don't want to get all sweaty and all exerted every time they go someplace, so they drive.
Hmm. That makes sense. You said, talking to Time magazine earlier this year, they shouldn't make comedy movies because comedy should be short and the last third is always torture and all the energy's gone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So why did you break your rule to make a movie?
I didn't realize actually how difficult it was until I got into it myself. And having done the TV show and having had success with it, naturally, you know, I was a little arrogant and thinking, oh, I could do that. That's easy. You know, we'll just do three TV shows and stitch them together, you know. But it was much more difficult than I thought. And I have much more respect for filmmakers now. It is quite a challenging little racket to put one of these things together.
Let's see a little bit of the movie. This is Jerry's character, Barry, meeting a mosquito.
Oh, my, what horrible thing has happened here? Look at these faces. They never knew what hit them. And now they're on the road to nowhere.
Just keep still.
What? You're not dead?
Do I look dead? Hey, man, they will wipe anything that moves. Now, where you headed?
To Honey Farms. I am onto something huge here.
I'm going to Alaska. Moose blood. Crazy stuff. Blows your head off. I'm going to Tacoma.
What about you?
He really is dead.
All right.
I should have pointed out they're on a windshield.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you're doing stand-up, you can gauge how it's working from audience response. When you spend 4 years making a movie, how do you have any idea what's working?
The night of the premiere is a little tense. You know, you spend 4 years making this thing, and then you just kind of put it out there and kind of hope.
So what's it like for you sitting in a cinema with an audience, knowing that you can't work the room?
It's uncomfortable. It's very uncomfortable.
Were you right up the front in the premiere or right up the back like this, or where were you?
I was in the middle.
That's bad.
Yeah, it was bad because it was a long way out anyway I was going to run.
And people are going to see you if you need to escape.
Yeah, but luckily it went very well.
When you first got the MC job at the comic strip, you were just 22.
That's right.
You said that was truly one of the greatest days of your life. Mm-hmm. Why was that such a shiny moment for you?
Well, it was the end of working. You know what I mean? I was a waiter at that time, and I was working at night as a comedian. Not working. I mean, I wasn't getting any money. And when they made me an MC, that was, I think, $25 a night. And it was three nights a week. And I thought, hey, I could live on this, you know. And then I would just be a comedian. And that was, so I went back to the restaurant and I took off the apron and I gave it to the guy. And that, I'll never forget that moment of handing him that apron and going, that's it. And I thought, I'll never work again. So like when people say to me, oh, 4 years to make the movie was so hard, I can't take that kind of whining. You know, I mean, it's not hard, it's fun. You're in show business. I mean, it's like a dream.
The first time you performed stand-up, you bombed badly. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to go back?
Well, I didn't say anything. It was one of the reasons I bombed so badly.
What happened?
Well, I didn't realize that when you get up in front of an audience, it actually, you know, is scary right off the bat. You know, I'd watched other comedians, and I thought, well, the audience seems to kind of be laughing, and then you just say things that are funny, and they laugh even more. But that's not what it is. They don't laugh at all. They just sit there, and you have to make them laugh, you know. So I wasn't quite rehearsed, and I went up on stage, and I could not remember one thing that I was going to... All I could remember was the topics that I wanted to talk about. This is absolutely true. So I stood there, I was totally panicked, and I just went, the beach. driving, my parents, and I was on stage for about 3 minutes, and then I just said, good night, you know, those are the subjects, I don't have any of the jokes. That was literally my first show.
So why did you go back?
Well, I thought I should at least try the jokes before I quit, before I give this all up, and the next time it went okay.
Your dad, Kel, was a big influence on you, is that right?
Yes, yes, he was. He was a funny guy, and he was a guy who didn't function in a structured environment. So he completely related to me not wanting a job either. You know, he had worked for a few companies and just couldn't get there on time and just couldn't really handle it, you know. So when he became a salesman, you know, they just go out and they kind of structure their own day, and you just wander from store to store selling whatever you're selling, then he did well. So he really thought, well, a comedian's kind of like that. And he loved jokes also. He used to keep a joke file himself. He used to tell me this joke, that he's like this joke about this guy who comes home and his wife is in the bathroom and... He suspects that there's some hanky-panky going on, and he pulls back the shower curtain, and there's another man behind the shower curtain, and he says to the man, what are you doing here? And the guy goes, well, everybody's got to be someplace.
And do you sometimes, even when you perform now, notice bits of your father in the way you perform?
Yes, you do. You know, it's a funny thing about your parents is even when they're gone, my father's gone now, over 20 years, but you actually feel them in your body. Physically, you kind of do things that they did, and I don't know if that's from watching them or it's just DNA, you know, but sometimes when I'm performing, I feel my feet or my posture. I feel like I look like my dad right now, you know. That's a nice feeling.
What about your mom? Was she funny? Or is she funny?
Kind of funny. Not really that funny.
What you do is what's called observational comedy. You observe. So do you sometimes have to consciously switch yourself off just to live your life, or are you forever sucking
stuff
in?
No, I don't really turn it off. It's just there, you know. You just, I don't know what it is, but you just get ideas.
So as you're talking to people, is stuff just flying into your head?
Yeah. Don't you find that happens to you too?
I've been treated for that.
Oh, really?
Sometimes, you know, you do get that completely unbidden thought. But is it something you also train your brain to do, or do you just trust to the process?
You kind of, like, pick things out as they go by, you know, and you go, maybe I could do something with that, you know. I was in Florida recently, and I noticed that they have a different type of walker that the old people are using now. You know these aluminum walkers that the old people have with their tennis balls on the bottom that in case a game should pop up unexpectedly, I guess. I noticed now they have like a three-legged walker with wheels on it and brakes at the top. And I thought, if you need brakes on your walker, perhaps you've been misdiagnosed.
Exactly right.
You know.
So you've been here a few times. What do you observe about us? What do you notice about Australians?
Well, Australia is comedy heaven. All comedians that I know love Australia because of the humor in the culture. Now, humor is in certain cultures and it's not in others. It's just nobody knows why or what it is. But this place, when you come here to perform, is like one of the greatest places because people are funny and like to have fun, and their laughter is always very near the surface. You don't have to work too hard to get it. And they, you know, comedians like to be around audiences that like to laugh. I feel like this is kind of like my comedy home outside of the U.S. If I was deported, I would move here.
I want to show a little bit from Seinfeld.
Okay.
This is from, one of the many famous episodes, The Contest.
First she screams, George, what are you doing, my God? Then it looked like she was going to faint. She started clutching the wall, trying to hang on to it. Man. I didn't know whether to try and keep her from falling or zip up.
What did you do?
I zipped up.
So she fell?
Yeah. Well, I couldn't run over there the way I was.
No, I guess you couldn't.
I wouldn't think so.
So she fell, and then she started screaming, my back, my back. So I picked her up. I took her to the hospital.
How is she?
She's in traction.
Sorry.
It's not funny, Elaine.
I know, I'm fine.
That was fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you.
I always got the impression watching the show, I'm watching that back then, that you were about to burst out laughing.
Always. Always. I love the show. So I would be in the show, and instead of playing my part, I'd be just watching it.
George and Kramer and Elaine were constructs, and you were playing yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So what about your character wasn't you?
Well, I don't speak in a scripted format in real life. But other than that, it's pretty much me. I mean, whatever I said it the way I would say it, and I just reacted the way I would react. So, you know, for me, it was a documentary.
That's an awful lot of you to put out there.
Yeah. But you see, that's the difference between comedians and actors. Actors want to dissolve into this character and have people not even know it's them and have them see them in different parts and have them be unrecognizable. And comedians are just the opposite. We're trying to get rid of everything that is not exactly us.
You're not a huge fan of the way we adulate actors, mm-hmm. are you? What is it about our adulation of them that
some actors that are absolutely brilliant, but most of them, you know, they're not writing the material. They're, you know, not directing. They're not producing. They're just kind of stand here, put this jacket on, and say this when I point at you, you know. And then have people go, oh, we've got some, we have to give this man a trophy. He's a genius, you know.
So, we won't tell Russell Crowe you said that.
Russell Crowe is one of the people that you would not say that about.
No. Or two.
No, because he really does bring some magic to it that you go, I don't know where that came from. There are actors that are geniuses.
When you finished Seinfeld, you decided, you went back to your roots to do stand-up, mm-hmm. but then you did something even harder. You threw out all the material that worked, the tried and true stuff, and started all over again.
Mm-hmm.
What prompted that decision?
I had seen comedians do this, like Richard Pryor. I'd seen him do it. I'd seen Bill Cosby do it. And as a young man, I would watch them in awe of how they would... I mean, Richard Pryor used to go to the Comedy Store in the 70s, and he would just go on stage with absolutely nothing, no jokes, and he would just start talking and trying to create material. And all the comedians would stand in the back watching him do this. And then 6 months would go by and 8 months would go by and people would be just shaking their heads going, man, he's lost it, you know. And then 10 months or a year and he'd have this incredible act because he refused to go backwards. He would only, you know, do brand new things. And I just thought that would be something that I would like to do someday. And I thought after the TV series, this would be a perfect time to try it.
You made a documentary about the process of rebuilding your act.
Yes.
Called The Comedian.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what it's like when you're starting with new material.
So in the end, whatever it is, whether it's 3 days or 7 days, you're still irritated, still annoyed, still frustrated, still hating the whole experience all the way through. And now my point here... This is my point. What are you applauding for? That was absolutely excruciating.
I think it's fantastic you showed that. Why did you want to show that?
One of the big questions I get as a comedian is people say, where do you get your material? And I thought I would show how hard it is to get it. I thought some people might find it interesting.
Did you expect that to be the process, that you would go out there and
sure.
So you were happy to put yourself through that pain?
Happy? No.
No. Prepared.
Prepared, yes. Yeah. Yes, it's just what you go through. You know.
And after a night like that, where it's fallen over,
mm-hmm.
what are you like when you go home? I'm trying to put that nicely, of course.
Well, there are many products that they sell in these situations that are perfect for an evening like that. There's pastries, there's many alcoholic beverages that are sold and legally used, you know. And once you're at home, nobody knows the quantities.
Your manager, your longtime manager, George Shapiro, is here. Hello, George.
Hi. Nice to see you, Andrew.
Nice to see you, too. EP of Seinfeld as well. George, when Jerry is building new material and some of it isn't working, as his manager, are you brutally honest with him, or you're just trying to...
Well, you could ask him. Sometimes I've gotten whacked around a little bit for my honesty, but I've always been honest.
George will tell you that and there's no one tougher on me than me.
Yeah. I don't have to be tough on him because he's tougher, but I am honest with him.
So
George, by the way, has been managing me for 27 years.
Because, Jerry, you've said that you're obsessed with the art of telling a joke.
Mm-hmm.
What does it take to get it right?
Sometimes you find yourself in the right moment with the audience. And the audience, see, the thing the audience never knows is that they are making the performance. You can't make an entire audience laugh if they don't want to. So they kind of will, if they're in the right place, or you can kind of maneuver them into the right place, they can make you give them a performance that's better even than you thought you could give.
What's not funny for you? What do you consider bad taste?
Bad taste?
Yeah.
I don't have any particular taste. You know, I don't find anything offensive as an audience member myself. To me, I only care about what's funny and what's not funny. I have my own style that I like to work in, which is clean. I don't like to use any sexual situations or dirty words. It just keeps me writing better jokes. You have to write a better joke to do well if you don't use any of those things. So it's just the thing that I do for myself.
You've described comedy as socialized aggression, that if you're not cranky, mm-hmm. you're not funny. Now, mm-hmm. you strike me as an extraordinarily happy guy with a great life.
Well.
So where does the cranky... Where does the cranky come from?
Well, you're born with that. I mean, I was at a restaurant, an absolutely magnificent restaurant I was taken to before the show today. We're there, and they didn't tell me that I was coming to be on your show in 5 minutes. And I'm wolfing down gigantic desserts, and, you know, we're playing with the appetizers. And they go, okay, we got to go. We go, why? Well, you're going on TV in 5 minutes. Well, I got a little cranky.
And because I have a limited imagination, what are you like when you get a little cranky?
I see why you call the show Enough Rope. I understand that now. Well, I try and be funny in the cranky. Because you want to continue to entertain. Although in this particular moment that I'm describing to you, I was not being funny. I was saying things like, oh, good planning, everybody. Sitting there going, I'll have another chocolate cannoli TV in 5 minutes. It worked out fine, though, didn't it?
Absolutely. For you, fun is at the core of being funny, that sort of sense of childishness. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Has having your own kids heightened that sense of childishness in you?
Not really. Around them, it has. I will do anything to make my kids laugh. I don't care how embarrassing it is, and I can't believe how the ridiculous things that I will do to make them laugh.
Do you throw yourself around? Do you? Are you?
I throw
physical?
Them around.
Yeah.
And then I throw myself on top of them, and you know, you'll just do silly things, embarrassing things. You know, body function things are very funny to children and to adults.
Absolutely.
Also,
you know.
And even though I don't feel it's appropriate for a sophisticated audience like yours. I will, in the privacy of my own home, I will laugh at certain things.
I think we're getting a mental picture here which is perfectly sufficient. Are you looking forward to them coming to see you when they're old enough, because they're still quite young, coming mm-hmm. to see you do stand-up?
Yes, very much. Well, my daughter is 7. I think she's about ready to... this year I'm going to bring her to a show, and I don't quite know what she's going to make of it. I think it's going to be very interesting.
What does she think Dad does?
Well, she knows that Dad tells jokes, although most of them now think that Dad's a bee. You know, and they tell... We heard them talking the other day. One kid said, my dad's a dentist. What does your dad do? My dad's a bee. Because that is what I've been for most of their life.
Yeah. 4 years, that's
yeah,
right.
Four, you know... I have a son who's 4, so, you know, I've been a bee his whole life.
You've described marriage as, like, the greatest comedy gold vein in history. Mm-hmm. What is it about marriage that amuses you?
Well, it's, it's an untenable situation. that people volunteer for. And then have to figure out, how am I going to survive this, you know? Well, that's what you call a good comedy premise. You know, what if 4 people made a bet that they could restrain themselves for, in a wager? Well, that's an absurd situation, and you volunteer for that. It's the same thing. It's funny.
You've always said you'd never do another sitcom after Seinfeld, but there must be a part of you that's quietly writing one about marriage.
There is, because all my friends are married, And I always think of, gee, if all the stuff that we do, you know, I would love to do it in a sitcom. And I guess if I did another sitcom and it would be about marriage, I'd just call it Mrs. Seinfeld.
When you look back on your single self, because you were famously single for a long time, what do you think?
Well, to me, the funny thing about being single, see, when I had married friends and I wouldn't visit them when I was single because I thought their life was so pathetically depressing. And then, now that I'm married, and I have single friends, and I feel I don't really like to be with them now, because I find their lives trivial and meaningless. And I think in both cases I was correct. But... You know, I always make this joke about how, you know, married, single guys will say, oh, we can hang out, you know, we can talk. Because I don't want, if you're married, you want to talk about your wife when you're with another guy.
Yeah.
You know, and single guys say, well, I have a girlfriend. I go, that's wiffle ball, you know. That's not, I'm in, you're playing paintball. I'm in Iraq.
On a tour of emotional duty. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
When George Burns died, you went and lit a cigar and sat outside his house.
Andrew, you know everything.
No, that's why I'm asking.
Yeah.
What was it about him you wanted to pay tribute to?
He is a master of enjoying life, which as you grow, I think you find is a very rare quality amongst the human species, that we kind of go through this experience and we struggle with various things and we oftentimes fail to stop and go, you know what, this is pretty great, just on a basic level. And George Burns was one of those people who just appreciated, hey, I'm in show business, life is great.
You gave a talk at a New York school. Tony Bennett, I think, asked you to speak, and you gave
them... I am absolutely stunned at the detail of research.
Yeah, I know, it's...
You must... Honestly, seriously. You do, like, one show every 6 months.
That's
and just
right, yeah.
Study and study and study this person.
You,
every aspect of
you
life.
Are the most anal man in show business. You said that you sat with every animator for every frame.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't accuse me of being anal.
No, I guess not.
Although I appreciate
I know, but,
the compliment.
All right.
Do you remember the rules of life? You had three rules of life.
I never accused you of being anal. I said you were impressive research.
Oh, in that case, I apologize for hearing.
My three rules of life, and this is, you know, I'd never spoken at a school. You know, they get invited when you're a celebrity to sometimes... be a speaker at the commencement ceremonies, and I had never done it, and I never knew what would I say, you know. And I just sat down with a pad and paper, and I thought, well, what are my three rules of life? And I came up with bust your ass, pay attention, and fall in love. And so I talked to the kids about these are the three things you need to know to succeed in life. And bust your ass is a just basically, whatever you do, just kill yourself. Work as hard as you can. Only good can come of it. And pay attention is just, people just don't notice enough about what's going on around them. And just, you can absorb and learn from everything around you all the time. You know, ask people questions all the time. And fall in love isn't really a romantic love, because I think there are, and this kind of gets back to your George Burns thing, is like you... One thing I did kind of get from him is, like, if I get a really good cup of coffee, I like to just go, you know what, just hang on a second. This is a fantastic cup of coffee. Isn't this a great... And I'll ask everyone, isn't this great coffee? Because, you know, it's not always great. This one is great, you know. And that is one of the things that I really did learn from him and why I had such respect for him is that I will stop and make that moment, you know. You will enjoy life more. If you do that, you know, you get a great parking spot. Just go. Just hold it a second. I mean, look at that spot. I mean, we could have been blocks away and we're right here.
See, that to me is wisdom. I think you've mm-hmm. learned wisdom, which is a rare quality.
It is
quality.
A kind of wisdom, yes.
So having invested so much of your life in this movie, what does its success or failure mean to you?
Well, what it is to me is that I feel I did my best, and all I want to do, I feel like all I'm supposed to do, and I don't know why I think this, is I feel like I'm supposed to make people laugh, and a lot of people do ask me, you know, you've done so much comedy, and why don't you write something that's a little deeper or a little more emotional, or why don't you try? And I just don't feel like that's what I'm supposed to do. I don't know why. So it was very important to me to come here with the movie and show it to the Australian audience. I would not have missed that. And so I sat in the theater last night and I listened to them laughing and I thought, well, that's it. You know, that's it. You know, I don't care about the grosses. I don't care about, you know, and then they will come to me and tell me, well, here's how much money it made in this in Melbourne. And say, yeah, fine, whatever. I heard them laughing and that's it.
And that's pretty good. Well, comedy is a high calling. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, Jerry Seinfeld. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew.